Good evening, everybody. I'm Lissa Muscatine. I'm a co-owner of the store along with my husband, Brad Graham. And on behalf of our fabulous staff here at Politics and Prose, we welcome all of you this evening. It is a bit unusual for both of us to do an introduction to a book, but tonight Brad and I will both be sharing this introduction. And that's because there was an organized effort, as some of you may know, to get us to cancel this event. And we felt very strongly about the need to therefore appear together and explain why we had no intention of canceling the event. First, let me just say a few basic points about the books we select for events. What we don't do is avoid a book because it's controversial, nor do we seek one out for that reason. Before scheduling an author, we try to assess first and foremost whether what he or she has written represents a work worthy of consideration. We do that by looking at who's decided to publish it, what the critics have said about it, and when we have advanced galleys, what our staff thinks of it. In the specific case of our author tonight, Stephen Jimenez, and his book about the murder of Matthew Shepard 15 years ago, we chose to hold an event because Stephen is an established journalist, writer, and producer who's done extensive research into an important case, and because his work has been taken seriously by a number of respected publications and reviewers. In The Book of Matt, Steve essentially calls into question the prevailing view of Matthew Shepard's death. Matthew, as many of you no doubt recall, was a 21-year-old gay college student whose death at the hands of two men was widely portrayed and accepted as a gruesome, appalling case of anti-gay hate. The two men convicted of killing him went to prison, and the crime triggered a national awakening about the harsh realities of homophobic violence. But as Stephen started looking into the case, initially for the purpose of writing a screenplay, he began questioning whether it really was a case of bigoted murder. And in the Book of Matt, he concludes that Matthew was not killed for being gay, but for more complicated reasons having to do with drugs and money. These findings have understandably offended and angered a number of people, including Matthew's family and friends and many supporters of gay rights. That the publication of Stephen's book has coincided with the 15th anniversary of Matthew's murder deepens the hurt. Critics of the book have been vocal. There have been articles and statements debunking it as being full of untrustworthy sources, factual errors, rumors, and innuendo. Critics have asserted that every person who was close to Matthew has also spoken out against the book. The lead police investigator in the case has been quoted rejecting Stephen's theory that this was a robbery or a drug deal gone wrong. And Brad will tell you the other half of this introduction.
At the same time, the publisher of the book and other supporters of it maintain that that many of the criticisms have themselves contained errors. They note that the book is primarily composed of named and reliable sources, and all anonymous sources have been verified by others. In addition, they say that many people who were close to Matthew have not spoken out against the book, but have actually come forward in favor of it. Now, Steve's reporting was taken seriously enough by ABC TV to have resulted in a piece on the program 2020 back in 2004 after Steve's initial research. There's been respectful discussion of the book in such mainstream media as NPR and in such publications as The Advocate. Commentator Andrew Sullivan has endorsed the book as a worthy work of journalism. It's not really our place here at Politics and Prose to adjudicate these claims and counterclaims. I did promise one of those who has been leading the protest of the book that I would at least make the audience here this evening aware of the controversy and note the objections to the book. Nonetheless, this person started an email petition drive to try to get P&P to cancel this event. The petition called the event tasteless and accused us of being in it, quote, only for the book sales. And that really galls me when anybody tells us that we're in something for the money, because anybody really in the book selling business these days knows that this is not where you go to make a lot of money. Anyway, I can assure everyone there are easier ways to make a buck. But if we succumbed to such attempts at censorship, we at this store wouldn't be true to one of our central missions. P&P has long played a role as more than just a retail outlet. It's also an established forum for community discussion on a broad range of topics. In a democracy like ours, such forums are essential. This does not mean, as those protesting this evening's event have alleged, that we believe, quote, every author, despite the bigotry and lies they are spreading, should have a platform here at PNP. But we do believe that citizens should have opportunities to hear diverse and sometimes divergent views and to engage in respectful debate about those views, even if the views are controversial. I just would urge everyone to read the book before making up your mind about it. As one reviewer said, writing in Oasis magazine, after reading Jimenez's book, Shepherd is still a tragic figure, but now I know more about his life and that he was loved and that he was a good friend, that he was interesting and curious, that he had dreams and goals that conflicted with how he lived his life, that he was troubled, that he was imperfect, and that he still aspired to be better than his life and situations in a future that never happened. After 15 years of knowing Matthew as a martyr, his pointless death isn't any less sad or tragic, knowing him merely as a flawed human. Now, Steve plans to speak for a bit, and then he'll take questions. If you have a question, please step up to the microphone there, or microphone there, even though it's a small group, because we do record these events so that we can post them online. We know that even given the passionate views of that some of you may have in this room, that the discussion will remain considerate and thoughtful. Please join me in welcoming Steve Jimenez.
Good evening. What I'd like to say, just I'm very aware of what has kind of happened with bookstores in the last few days, but I'd like to say that this has also happened with some journalists. My first bookstore appearance was in the Castro in San Francisco at Books, Inc., and there was just a really lovely and smart Asian-American female journalist who came to do a TV interview with me. And the event itself turned out just fine, but before the event began, we sat down, and she was really nervous, and she said, you know, I'm really nervous because I'm part of a group of gay bloggers, and people have been telling me that this will not be good for my career if I interview you. I did an interview yesterday with a radio host in Madison, Wisconsin, where I'll be going in a couple of weeks. And the radio interview, Stu Levitan, has been, he's been a radio host for, I believe, about 25 years and is very respected in the Madison community. And he, too, was being pressured, and people were labeling him and actually, indeed, saying things that were almost hateful because he was doing an interview with me. So far so good. I must say that every event that we've had has been just great conversations, questions, dialogue, debate. Probably for me the most satisfying event so far was meeting with a group of gay and lesbian Catholics at St. Francis Xavier Church in Chelsea, where I knew right up until I walked into the event that the event had been sponsored by three groups, and that there had really been some controversy and people wanting to cancel the event. Why were they having me? But the event turned out to be really quite amazing because many conversations happened over the course of the evening, and by the end of it, you know, I think everyone felt that it was really productive and constructive. So I hope something similar may happen here. What I've been doing, and typically I haven't been talking with a mic, but since this is being recorded, I will speak here. I feel a little bit like a college lecturer here. But what I'd like to do is just tell you a little bit about the background of the story. I'm just going to ask, has anyone here actually read the book? Two people. Okay. So I think this will be useful just as an introduction, because I'd like to give you a sense of how I became involved in this story, because I think it will be good background. In early 2000, in February of 2000, I went to Laramie to write a screenplay for a made-for-television movie about the murder. And the way in which that happened is I was as just appalled, horrified, shocked as anyone when I first heard about Matthew's murder. And I was particularly shocked because I had spent time in Wyoming. I had had a writer residency at a foundation in Wyoming a number of years before Matthew was killed. But it was my first time in Wyoming, and it was on this remote cattle ranch in northeastern Wyoming. And I really fell in love with the landscape and, in many ways, the people. So when I heard this about Matthew, it really just had kind of an added shock. But it wasn't when the crime first happened that I made the decision to go to Laramie. I was really appalled by the tragedy, but it was not until a year later, when Aaron McKinney was sentenced, that I read a statement in the New York Times of Dennis Shepard, his father. I had seen the Shepards, his mom and dad, in news reports, but it was when I read the statement of his father in court at Aaron McKinney's sentencing, it was just such a heartfelt statement, and it was as if he was really bearing his soul. I'm paraphrasing here. He said something like, "Why wasn't I a better father and friend? Why wasn't I there when he needed me most? How will I ever get an answer to those questions now?" And there was something deeply personal to me about that statement, but somehow the father and son story kind of came into the foreground for me and just pulled me. So it was soon thereafter that I made the decision to go to Laramie with the idea of writing a screenplay. I spoke to a producer colleague in LA. He was interested in the idea. And so I went there to do research, believing that I knew what the main outlines of the story were, but I wanted to go through court documents, the huge file that was in the Albany County Courthouse. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the case record was under seal by the court for 1 year. From the time shortly after the attack happened, the prosecutor in the case moved to have all the records sealed. And all witnesses in the case were placed under a gag order by the court. So for the year between just after the crime and the perpetrators were arrested, until McKinney was convicted to two life sentences, journalists could not examine the record. They couldn't look at the police reports. They couldn't look at witness statements. They couldn't look at things that were compiled during the police investigation. And they couldn't go talk to witnesses who had been in the fireside bar that night, people that knew Aaron and Russell, not just principals, not just witnesses, but also people that worked on the case, people that worked in the courthouse, law enforcement. So I was very interested when I got to Laramie to see this voluminous amount of material, because in November of 1999, when McKinney was sentenced, as far as the media was concerned, the story was over. McKinney got his life sentences and they left town. And so just as a writer, I really had very little experience as a journalist before that. I was fascinated that this wealth of material was there in front of me. On the first day I was in the courthouse, I noticed the prosecutor, Cal Ruruka, kind of walking back and forth between a couple of offices, talking to people in the courthouse. I recognized the picture because I had seen him in news shots and things. And I just approached him and I said, I'm doing this research. Would you be willing to talk with me for a few minutes? We went into his office and the first conversation lasted for about 45 minutes. But from that meeting, and then I began a long series of interviews with him. Interviews that I did in Laramie and also that I did by phone when I returned to New York. But for the first few months, he was kind of circling me like a fox, because he didn't know exactly. I told him what I wanted to do, but he wasn't really sure of my intentions. And he told me right up front. He said, "I will not have anything to do with a project that is going to inflict more harm on the Shepherds, on the Shepherd family, because he had gotten very, very close to the Shepherd family in the year that this was going on, and in many ways was an advocate, was the biggest advocate for the Shepherd family. Using all the documents, making copies, I did eventually about 150 hours of interviews with the prosecutor that won McKinney and Henderson's convictions. I finished a draft of the screenplay. It took about 8 months, and I returned to Laramie in October of 2000 with a completed draft, a first draft of the screenplay. It was still a little rough, but the purpose of the visit was I wanted the prosecutor to fact check what I had written in that first draft. And on a Saturday at the courthouse, the Albany County Courthouse, he went into his office with the screenplay to read it, and I said, you know, write notes on the page or whatever. And I was in the law library down the hall, where he had often met with Dennis and Judy Shepherd during the trial proceedings. And I was going through, you know, sort of a last stack of folders. There were newspaper articles, there were a few documents, and I wanted to be sure that if there was anything I needed a copy of, that I could make it, because I thought this would be my last trip to Laramie, unless, in fact, the film got made and then I would come back later. And while I was going through one of these folders, I found a letter that was tucked in between some newspaper articles, and it was an anonymous letter, and I quote from it in the book. It was handwritten, and it was an anonymous letter written to the prosecutor. And essentially what the letter said is the gay panic defense that Aaron McKinney used in his trial is false, that Aaron McKinney is very familiar with gay guys and gay bars, that it said he was either gay or bisexual, and that he had that this couldn't be. But what really caught my attention is that the letter named a real life person in Laramie, the limousine driver Doc O'Connor, who's kind of a notorious figure there. And I had read about Doc O'Connor in magazine and news articles. He was portrayed somewhat prominently, but there was a feeling, even in the photographs I had seen early, that Doc was kind of a shadowy figure. But it was a named person. Of course, you know, as a journalistic source, an anonymous letter is meaningless. But it was that letter that made me start thinking and asking myself, could there be something else going on here? So I didn't even tell the prosecutor, who by then I had gotten to be fairly good friends. We spoke, you know, quite often. I didn't tell him then. I told him later. But I just made a copy of the letter, slipped it into my briefcase, and I left town. And then the question was, what am I going to do? So I decided that I would start to make some more inquiries and talk to some other people in Laramie, and eventually, obviously, met Doc O'Connor. But the idea really was, if there's something else here, what was it? And I was curious to find out what it was. The letter suggested that Aaron McKinney might have been a male prostitute, that he might have done some of this for money or other favors, someone giving him a place to live or things like that. That was sort of what I would call almost like phase one of this project. In 2002, I was commissioned, I took what I then found in my research, which I found things that were supported that anonymous letter from real sources, you know, with names, and I went to the New York Times Magazine, and the New York Times Magazine commissioned me to write an article based on what I presented to them, and the article was commissioned by Adam Moss, who, if any of you know the publishing world in New York, Adam Moss is one of the most respected gay authors in the business. He did leave the New York Times Magazine, and he now runs New York Magazine, but he commissioned the piece. And I worked on the Times Magazine piece over a period of 2 years. In 2004, when I submitted a complete draft of the, it was really a completed first draft of the magazine article, the Times Magazine killed the story. And when they killed the story, there was not a single word of criticism about the reporting. In fact, they really said, you know, do we really want to go into the darker aspects of this story? And it was killed in 2004. While while I was talking with the New York Times Magazine about the story, I was simultaneously talking to ABC News 2020. A friend of a friend who was a longstanding producer at ABC News, Glenn Silber, and I were talking about the possibility of the ABC piece and the magazine piece coming out at the same time. But I thought, well, when the magazine killed the piece, 2020 would kill the piece too. But in fact, they didn't kill the piece. They said, let's do this. Now, over those 2 years working on the magazine story, I had accumulated a lot more information. The executive producer of 2020, David Sloan, is also, you know, has been out as a gay man in broadcasting for a long time and is very involved in a lot of New York City gay causes, has won awards from GLAAD and from other gay organizations. So David Sloan said, yes, we're going to do this, and I'm going to give it an hour. When the 2020 piece came out, in fact, before it came out, much like the book, there was controversy generated before anyone even saw the piece. There were, you know, and I won't even name the organizations, but there was pressure coming from organizations contacting ABC News saying, you should let us into the editing room to see this and give you feedback before we put it on the air. And David Sloan, to his great credit, said, we're working here as journalists, and we're working independently, and we're not going to succumb to that pressure. But organizations sent emails out. They launched a national email campaign saying, you know, this piece is going to suggest that maybe this wasn't a hate crime in the way that we all thought. And but we continued to do our work, and the piece aired. After the piece aired, there was some criticism that came, and I will say it was essentially from the gay press, notably Gay City News in New York City. But in terms of other journalists, there was nothing came forward to actually challenge or debunk anything that was put in that original ABC piece. The only actual thing that I remember is that there was, a two-line mention in Frank Rich's column where, in the New York Times, where he kind of took a swipe at Elizabeth Vargas, who was the correspondent and co-anchor for the 2020 piece. But it was Frank Rich's swipe was a critical swipe. It wasn't based on any actual evidence or information. So that was it. We went on for that piece to win an award from the Northwestern University School of Journalism the award was specifically for correcting misleading and inaccurate news stories. The piece won a Writers Guild of America award for best news report analysis or commentary of the year. And these were, in both cases, my colleagues in journalism. And that really, you know, examined, you know, kind of looked at the work on its own merits. So when we finished the ABC piece, there was reporting that some of it didn't make it into the program. And there was also additional reporting that I wanted to do. So after the ABC News piece was over, I decided to continue the reporting. I wasn't sure at that point, would this be a follow-up on 2020? Would it be another news magazine show, or would I write a book? And ultimately, I made the decision to write a book. So the book has quite a bit more material than was broadcast in the original 2020 piece. Just a few of the reasons why I decided to write this book, and I can't address all the specifics of the controversy right now, but one of the reasons I decided to write the book is that personally, as a gay man who came out in the mid-1970s and lived through in the early 80s, mid-80s, late 80s, lived through the worst period, okay, of the first, what I think of as the first AIDS era, when, I mean, I can't even calculate the high percentage of friends that I lost during that period, but many, many friends and colleagues, you know, passed away. And at that time, there was very little treatment, and people passed away very quickly. You found out, and 3 months later, they were dead. But there was a kind of, I think in the gay community, certainly in larger urban areas, but elsewhere too, almost a sense of a post-traumatic stress that we were all going through. You know, what is happening and where is this going to end? There was a very apocalyptic feeling associated with that. As I was doing work, you know, first for the 2020 piece, and then, you know, working on the book, when I came to realize, okay, what crystal meth was doing, the kind of epidemic it was becoming in the gay community, I'm not terribly familiar with, you know, its use in Washington, D.C., but at the beginning of the epidemic, it was hitting large cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York, and then began to move to other areas. But it was certainly already a presence in Denver, where Matthew Shepard lived before he moved to Laramie. But when I started seeing very reliable studies coming out of places like UCLA Medical Center that crystal meth was being tied, you know, crystal meth users and addicts, it was being tied to higher rates of HIV transmission. Because if you know anything about crystal meth, when you're on meth, you feel like you're 100 feet tall and very powerful and nothing can hurt you. And you're on this, you know, I mean, the come down from that is awful. But when you're on it, you feel that way. So there's something that's understandable about why people on crystal meth would feel like it's okay to have unprotected sex. But when I started to see that correlation, and this coming on the heels of the AIDS crisis, it really disturbed me. And I felt that I really wanted to address some of the things that I was finding out about this, the principle, some of the principles in this story. So what I thought I would do is to just read a short passage to you from the book, which involves something that happened in 2004 as I started to peel back some of the layers. As you may know, but I'll just mention it, crystal meth, when it really began to move, it moved through the kind of heartland of the country, through the Midwest, and then into the West, and was really becoming a huge problem in places like Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, Colorado, Montana, and it was really starting already to harm many rural places or small towns. It was also already a problem in the gay community. By 1998, when Matthew was killed, it was already becoming a problem. However, the national media, didn't really begin to report on this as a serious story until around 2004, and that was just the beginning. And that was the beginning of some of the articles that came out, even about the meth crisis in the gay community. But in terms of becoming a big story, it didn't really become a big story until 2006, 2007, when national news magazines began to put it on their covers. Oddly, or coincidentally, or maybe in some ways positively, it's the TV series Breaking Bad over the last 5 years that has really brought the world of crystal meth to the mass audience in terms of an understanding of what it is. But my first efforts in terms of talking about crystal meth were really in 2002 when I went to the New York Times Magazine, and in 2004 when that story was killed, the willingness of ABC News to begin to tell that story. But I'm going to begin just with I will read a couple of passages. I guess I need to stay here. I'm sorry. I'm going to read, it's just a couple of pages. It's about, I don't know, a third of the way into the book. And this is a short chapter called, it's chapter 19 of the book called Sleeping Dogs. On a Friday afternoon in late October 2004, a little more than 6 years after the murder, I drove 200 miles to meet Kyle, a former drug cohort of Aaron McKinney, alone at an isolated truck stop off I-80 in western Wyoming. Aaron McKinney was the principal perpetrator who actually slammed the barrel of a 357 Magnum into Matthew's skull repeatedly. I had interviewed Kyle twice before in prison, and he had been surprisingly cooperative, so I felt more or less safe. Still, I took precautions, since he had earlier advised me, "You don't know who you're dealing with," referring to his friends higher up on the drug-dealing food chain. Kyle worked in the oil fields and had just gotten off a shift. He was still in company overalls, his face and hands stained with crude. As we sat in the front seat of his parked car talking about Matthew Shepard, whom he had previously claimed to know only in passing, I suggested that Matthew might have gotten in over his head with drugs. Kyle snarled at me like I was an idiot. Yeah, and he was taking stuff away from the rest of us. Without warning, two other vehicles suddenly backed into spaces on both sides of us, wedging us in. When I saw what was happening, I leapt from the car and ran into the middle of the parking lot where there were more lights. Kyle shouted for me to get back in the car, but I refused. At that instant, a friend of mine, who was planted in a nearby truck monitoring the meeting, called my cell phone. "Get out of there, Steve," he yelled. "They're setting you up." "Stay in your car. Don't let them see you," I snapped back. Trying not to panic, but worried I would get run over or shot, I spun around several times to keep Kyle's car in view as I hustled across the parking lot to a truck stop restaurant. Before I reached the entrance, Kyle's vehicle and the other two tore out of the lot, tires screeching, heading for the ramp to the interstate. Seconds later, my friend picked me up in front of the truck stop, his face a sickly shade of white. In a halting voice, he told me how close he thought he had come to losing me there. I knew he was right. With his help, I had narrowly managed to escape, but clearly I had been given a message. Driving away from the truck stop, I took my friend's advice and crouched down on the floor of his truck, out of sight. Evidently, someone more powerful than Kyle had set me up. I hardly slept that night in Laramie. Waves of anxiety surged through me till late the next morning. Why had I put myself in danger like that? The next day, still agitated, I related my roadside experience to Prosecutor Cal Ruruka, the Shepherd prosecutor Cal Ruruka. He shook his head in disgust. "The methamphetamine trade has made Wyoming revert to the lawless anarchy of the old West," he remarked pungently. "It's deadly." By then, Cal had been voted out of office in Albany County after four elected terms. He was now prosecuting state and federal drug cases in the Twin Cities of Rock Springs and Green River, the epicenter of methamphetamine traffic for the Rocky Mountain West. After hearing my story, Cal told me about a colleague, a Wyoming judge, who had recently been surprised by an armed male intruder in the bathroom of his home one morning while shaving. The man was there to relay a message regarding a drug case in which he was awaiting sentencing by the judge. After a few curt words, the man quietly slipped away. I saw no point in asking what the judge decided with a gun staring him in the face. But Cal's reference to the Old West brought back a conversation I'd recently had about Matthew's murder with a veteran cop in the Albany County Sheriff's Office. Friendly, with a studied, good old boy charm, the cop leaned over his desk toward me, his chiseled, windburned face inches from mine. "You sure you're not quoting me on this?" he asked. "It's for background. I won't be using your name," I answered, trying to sound reassuring. "What happened to Matthew Shepard wasn't a hate crime, not at all," he confided in a low voice. "But why do you want to go digging into all that again? Why not let sleeping dogs lie?" I wasn't inclined to answer his question candidly. Instead of laying out my suspicions about the involvement of other parties beyond Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson in events surrounding Matthew's murder, I reminded him that the killing was a seminal national event, a lot like the civil rights killings of the 1960s, as if he were somehow unfamiliar with the stigma that continued to tarnish his hometown. The public has a right to know whether the murder was really a hate crime, I said with conviction, and if not, what was it? The cop stared at me as he sank back from his desk, shrugging doubtfully. Almost as an afterthought, he flashed me another knowing grin. But again, his eyes told me to let sleeping dogs lie. So what I'd like to do, there are a few shorter passages that I could read that I think will reflect on some of the themes. Oh, sorry. I'm just used to moving around. Sorry about that. What I thought I would do is just invite some question and discussion, and there are a couple of shorter passages that I might read that I think will that will address some of the things that were brought up by my host here. But I'd welcome your comments and thoughts, because it seems that there's been a lot of talk even before people have had a chance to read the book. There's certainly been a lot of that online. I will say that despite some of the agitation that I felt, that so far the conversations have just been very productive, very engaging. Just a very quick anecdote. While I was doing the event at Books, Inc. in the Castro, after the event, the woman that was there filming it for C-SPAN came up to the desk where I was signing books, and she was all teary. And she said, I just want to tell you, you know, my brother just got arrested a couple of weeks ago having to do with crystal meth. And he was jailed, and she just literally started to cry, the person that was shooting it for C-SPAN. I have just been encountering lots of other stories. Things have been coming onto the Facebook page. People from Laramie have written. And it feels like maybe the time is right. Maybe 15 years later, maybe we can talk about some of these things. Was it a seminal moment in our national history, as well as LGBT history? Absolutely. So much has happened over the last 15 years, and there is still a lot more to do. But I also think that there's something to be gained and benefited from talking about what the real circumstances were surrounding Matthew Shepard's murder in 1998. So, with that, I'd just like to invite some comment and questions. Thank you. Thank you. Would you like Jerry to go to one of that mic or that mic?
To use your own terminology about letting sleeping dogs lie,
yes.
I'm curious to know, after you found this material, did it ever occur to you to not go forward, to let sleeping dogs lie? Why did you feel compelled to?
Well, you know, it was something that I did really wrestle with for a while, and it was at intervals, particularly as I got pulled further into the drug world, and that became, you know, physically dangerous. But my main concern was, say, if we go back more than 5 years ago, my main concern was, could this in some way reverse gains that have been made? But the longer I went on and the more I found out, the more I felt that I really did need to write and tell this story as a gay man. And I wrote the book in the first person, and the book is really about my investigation of the murder and what I found over the period of time. But as I said, there was a certain feeling I had that after, you know, not just the AIDS period, but other struggles around gay rights, I felt it was really important to tell the truth. And I remembered during the AIDS period that famous slogan, silence equals death. And I thought, you know what? Silence does equal death around crystal meth, and I felt like I really wanted to tell the truth. And so I made that decision to do it.
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate your presentation, and revisionism has often had a... Is this working, or?
Yeah, oh, okay. I just wanted to lift mine up so I didn't have to keep bending down.
Has often had a bad name, but revisionism, in properly done by historians or journalists, is to revise errors. There are many things that have come out in history that are controversial, related even to people that a lot of people admire. I was doing research at the National Archives a number of years ago for someone who was writing a book about World War II, and the minutes of the Yalta conference were declassified. And in there, there's a conversation between Joseph Stalin and Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt, they exchanged some pleasantries, and I'm paraphrasing, but FDR said to Stalin, well, one of the big problems I have, and I'm not quoting exactly, I'm paraphrasing, you know, I have too many Jews in the United States, you know, I'd like to give them to you or something. And he made this anti-Semitic remark, and he didn't go on and on about it, but I wouldn't have expected that from someone of Franklin Roosevelt's stature. I remember years ago at the Holocaust Memorial Museum, Henry Morgenthau Jr., was talking about, related to the famous Morgenthau family, his father was in Roosevelt's cabinet. Mm. And he said they were the only Jewish family that the Roosevelts knew socially. And he referred to a letter that Eleanor Roosevelt had written to Franklin, saying, oh, it's too bad. He was at Harvard, and too bad, you know, there are so many Jews there. But the point he was making was that's not how she ended up. Yes, she said she wrote that, but she changed later. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to cover these things up, I can understand at the time why things maybe were kept secret for a long time. But, you know, people can change, and I think telling the truth is important, and people are often a product of the times and they live in. There's a lot of talk of Abraham Lincoln that, well, he was really racist, certain things he said about sending African Americans to Africa. But the fact is I'm running along too long, but I guess you get the point. So my question is, the Matthew Shepard killing, it was more about drugs? Is that what really was that went bad? And
well, what I would, let me say this. The original media accounts of almost every major news organization that reported on it, they were all referred to as strangers. Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson went into the bar. Matthew Shepard looked well-dressed, looked like he was gay, and they decided to target him for that reason. That version did later go through a couple of iterations, including that in the bar, Matthew Shepard made a sexual advance, and the two perpetrators to take him out and beat him up to teach him a lesson not to come on to straight people. It then went through another iteration with Aaron McKinney's in his trial claiming not that it happened in the bar, but that it was after they left and they got into the truck, while they were in the truck, that Matthew grabbed his leg. But what I will say is that Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard knew each other for many months before the crime happened. There were previous incidents that I talk about in the book when Aaron had threatened Matthew, or he was angry with Matthew, and there are multiple sources for having seen that before. And they had a friendship, but as we get closer to the time of the attack, there was friction between the two of them, and the friction was largely about drugs and money. But they also did have some sexual involvement as well. If I could just make one comment before the next question. Well, maybe I'll save that for later. Let me save that for later. Okay. Anyone else?
So, clearly, you must realize that your book is being used by sort of the right-wing fringe to sort of debunk the need for hate crimes laws.
Right. I am aware of that.
So, which is a very unfortunate sort of byproduct, I guess. But the question I have for you is, so in your book, you point out that the crystal meth community is bad news, and there's dangerous and it's full of very scary individuals, that young college students use drugs and sometimes even deal in drugs, and that gay men sometimes sleep with questionable people. That's what you put in your book. But the real question is, as a gay man, what do you believe about the need for hate crimes laws and the need for the passage of a hate crime law? And also, even after reading your book and sort of going to the facts, which I don't agree with or don't believe, but if I sort of let myself just say, what if that were the truth? Mm-hmm. What is not still a hate crime?
First of all, I didn't write the book to say that it was or wasn't a hate crime. I think that there's a big difference between hatred and hate crime, and I think the two things are put together often. Wyoming, as you know, did not have a hate crime law at the time this occurred, and there was also no federal law. But almost immediately, within a couple of days of this crime happening, the national media de facto called it a de facto hate crime. The President of the United States made comments, Bill Clinton, talking about the need to pass legislation, hate crime legislation that was in Congress. It was characterized as a hate crime before before the police even had an opportunity to investigate the case. From my many interviews with the prosecutor, Cal Ruruka, who has been both a state and federal prosecutor, it's his opinion that there wasn't sufficient evidence to even attempt to prosecute this as a hate crime. So that is one thing. The second thing is other police officers, including one of the lead homicide detectives, who took Aaron McKinney's recorded confession, who had a history of investigating Aaron McKinney previously on drug offenses, and who interviewed many witnesses in the case, has also gone on the record saying that this was about drugs and money. Now, let's talk about hatred. Of course there is hatred. Hatred is an underpinning to so many things in our culture, as is violence. And I'm more interested as a writer in looking into what are the complexities that continue to create in our culture violent events. I don't see the crime against Matthew Shepard as an isolated event. I see it in the context of other trends and other things going on in American culture. At the time this crime happened, and I trace this in the book, there were many things going on at the same it was as if it was a perfect storm of events. In the months prior to the attack on Matthew, the gay community was really under siege because some of the folks that you mentioned on the right, religious right conservatives, and I'll mention, two examples, Trent Lott and Pat Robertson. Trent Lott made a famous statement on television saying that gays were sinners, according to his reading of the Bible, and that they should seek treatment like kleptomaniacs and alcoholics do. Pat Robertson made a statement saying that homosexuality is the last step in the decline of Gentile civilization. The community was feeling tremendously under siege. There were ad campaigns trying to persuade people that they could, become straight if they wanted to, and they went through, certain kinds of therapy. But the other part of the national context was this happened 4 months after the James Byrd dragging death in Jasper, Texas, which was certainly really an unqualified hate crime from anything I've been able to read about it. But do I suggest that hatred is a factor here? I do. But that's different than going into a court of law before a jury, before a judge, with prosecutors and attorneys making legal arguments. Hate crime now has a legal meaning based on the Matthew Shepard Act and the law. And I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on hate crime. The point of the book is not to say this was not a hate crime. If certain people in the media on the right are using it in that way, I'm disappointed because it's a facile use of the book. I can say that there on the left, There have also been numerous lies on the internet. It's been suggested that all my sources in the book are drug dealers and people that lack credibility. I want to say that there is no one that I've met in 13 years working on this story who has more integrity than the prosecutor in this case, Cal Ruruka. And Cal Ruruka has gone through, you know, he's gone through my reporting and fact-checked many, many things over the years. And he also agreed to appear in the 2020 story on camera for the first time to acknowledge some truths that had never been brought up before. One of those things, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, if Aaron McKinney had not become involved with methamphetamine, Matthew Shepard would be alive today. This was a horrible, horrible murder driven by drugs, okay? I mentioned two police officers to you. Well, I mentioned Ben Fritzen, another officer in the case who arrested Russell Henderson on the night of the crime, Flint Waters, went on to become, not for the local law enforcement, but for the statewide Division of Criminal Investigation. He became the lead drug enforcement cop in Laramie. Flint Waters also disputed from the beginning that this was motivated by anti-gay bias. The issue, though, is not to go back and say, let's rewrite this and say it wasn't a hate crime. It's to say, let's look at the human complexities of what was going on here. If we're serious about dealing with hatred and violence, then let's find out what the confluence of forces were that created this horrible tragedy. That's why I wrote the book, not to say that there aren't hate crimes. Of course there are hate crimes. Of course there is anti-gay hatred. Was Matthew, over the course of his life, and perhaps on that evening as well, a victim of hatred? Absolutely and certainly. But what I'm saying is, on that night, with the specific circumstances that were going on, you know, in the months and weeks and days and hours before this crime happened, there was a lot more that was going on, especially the fact Aaron McKinney, who really enjoyed having sex with gay men, did not walk into a bar and look at Matthew Shepard and say, he looks gay, and now he's a redneck, and he's going to take him out and beat him to death. Aaron McKinney was after methamphetamine and money that night.
Why do you think that they did not explore the world of the drugs in this death, in this murder?
I think one of the reasons, the only place it came up significantly, and this was a year into the case, was when, during Aaron McKinney's trial, his defense lawyers called an expert on methamphetamine to talk about Aaron McKinney's personal use of methamphetamine. But they never got into the dealing or any of those other aspects. One reason, I think, and this is based on talking to many people that actually lived through the experience, is that the perception that it was driven by anti-gay hate got out to the national media so quickly, and I trace in the book exactly how it started, because Matthew was still alive. Matthew was in the hospital in Fort Collins, Colorado, when two friends of his, with perhaps some personal agendas of their own, and I'm not talking about a political agenda, but personal agendas, because they both knew Matthew quite well, started calling gay organizations and called a friend at the Casper Star Tribune, and from there it got picked up on Associated Press. And in the words of the prosecutor, it became a wildfire, that there was nothing pulling it back in. He, as a prosecutor, did not want to talk to the media at that point because he was really afraid of a mistrial. The media sensationalism around the case was that big. One of the ironies, now in retrospect, is that it was the defense team that brought up methamphetamine and the prosecutor who tried to keep the references out of the case. You know, several years later, the prosecutor was willing to acknowledge the role that methamphetamine played. But people don't understand that when prosecutors and defense lawyers are going into a courtroom, they're looking for the facts that can bolster their argument. But ultimately, these fellows were charged with felony murder and related charges, kidnapping, etc. But, you know, since there was no hate crime law, they were not charged with a hate crime. I did want to just, there was a thought that I was, just in case I forget it. What you mentioned before about revisionism, I've been asked about this in a couple of interviews. Frankly, I don't think of this as revisionism. Until this book, there has not been a major nonfiction book about the murder. There have been a couple. There was one book on by a University of Wyoming professor about life and politics in the aftermath of Matthew's murder. It was something of a series of sociological reflections and cultural reflections on the impact of the murder. Matthew's mother, Judy Shepard, wrote a memoir, The Meaning of Matthew. But it has taken 15 years, and I'm not talking about my 15 years, but 15 years for, you know, for some of the complexities to come out. But when you say revisionism, who actually went through the court documents and the police reports and went and interviewed principals in the case? It didn't happen. In my opinion, the two best pieces that came out on this case, Melanie Thernstrom wrote a piece in Vanity Fair that was pretty good. She interviewed quite a number of people. I think the best piece was written in Harper's by a journalist named Joanne Vipijeski. Joanne was bound by the fact that she couldn't interview many people. But I owe her a debt because I actually picked up in her tracks with the story, and I went to her, and she was willing to give me some information and sources that I was able to follow up with that she couldn't because of the deadline to publish the piece in 1999 before the case was over. So there were a couple of attempts, but no one could really put the pieces together. And as far as I know, I don't know of another book where someone has actually tried to go to the principals, to all the law enforcement people, and two of the law enforcement people that have criticized me, I did interview both of them, Dave O'Malley and Rob DeBrie. And, you know, even on NPR the other day, you know, they mentioned a toxicology report that Aaron McKinney hadn't been using meth. I have multiple sources named, including people that testified in the trial, and, you know, a very large body of information and evidence of the amount of drugs that Aaron McKinney was using prior to that time. If they have a toxicology report showing that Aaron McKinney wasn't using drugs, then produce it.
You haven't seen one that said he was using drugs.
What I can tell you, though, is as a journalist, it is accepted journalistic practice that if you have, okay, more than one named source, if you have two or three or four or five, and in this case, I have many named sources, and to suggest, as some people have on the internet, that they're all unreliable, that simply is not the case. Many of the people who have talked about this are not people that that had any kind of criminal record whatsoever. So for them to be called unreliable is just, it's just labeling them with something for an advantage that I don't know what does it gain for us.
I mean, that is my question, actually.
Sure.
I just directed a production of the Laramie Projects that's happening at Ford's Theater right now. So feel like I'm pretty, I've been fairly aware of and had many conversations with Judy Shepard and members of the community.
Sure.
Of Laramie. I guess what my, and listening to you here tonight, you are obviously a very intelligent man. It is that is not a question of mine. I'm confused as to, and in our doing our production of Laramie, we've had a lot of comments and particularly on things like the Washington Post site and from other people about, well, it's been said that this story is all false, so why should we listen to it?
Okay.
These are from people who have not read your book,
right,
who have decided that it is an anti-gay book. I've yet to come across the person who says, with the exception of, that was wonderful to hear, the review that said otherwise, that it colored Matthew in a different way. Your book is being used for anti-gay purposes. I've yet to see it used in any other way. So what is is the reason?
First of all, and you should know, first of all, let me ask you, have you read the book?
No.
Okay.
And
okay. I just wanted to understand that, so I can address. Yeah.
Sure. And I'm saying my thing is, you're saying if you haven't read your book,
right,
why say anything? But no, there are many people who haven't.
No, I wasn't suggesting that at all. I'm just saying
there are a lot of people who haven't read your book who are using it in an anti-gay.
Yes, and what I want to say is about that, that what I've noticed so far is that there is a broad range of commentary that's coming, that on the far right, we've seen comments that are much as what you're saying, but there are also two excellent pieces. One was, I believe, the American Conservative, and the other was the Conservative Thinker, that were extremely, extremely thoughtful. On the other side, on our side, it wasn't just the piece that you cited from Oasis. Aaron Hicklin, the editor-in-chief of Out Magazine, wrote a piece in The Advocate in which he actually said very positive things about the book. 2 days ago, Lewis Whittington, a Philadelphia gay journalist, published a piece on Edge online that was also very positive about the book. Last night at the Harvard Coop, an African-American woman who writes for Bay Windows, the gay paper in Boston, has had a very positive response to the book. Andrew Sullivan, has also written very positively about the book and read the book himself and sponsored a series of interviews with me on the Daily Dish. So to suggest, as one online source, Media Matters, said, that I'm attempting to de-gay Matthew is, I'm gonna say it plainly, it's baloney. What I wanna say to you about the Laramie Project, and I'm just gonna mention this, is that in the book, I mentioned two sources named. And these are two sources that were interviewed by the Laramie Project Company back at the beginning when they first went to Laramie right after this crime happened. And they were interviewed extensively. And they mentioned some of what they knew because both of them knew Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard. And they knew them in the same social circle and they knew them from the same parties. And they spoke about methamphetamine. And I talk about that in the book. I don't say anything else about the Laramie Project in the book, but I will say, as an artist, you owe it to your audience, to be truthful. And, in the current version of in the epilogue to the Laramie Project, the idea that methamphetamine had something to do with this was ridiculed, And I want to say I find that as a gay man and as a journalist really offensive. It was not, it was completely, completely false what was said about methamphetamine in the story, and to ridicule the idea that it had something to do with the crime when, back in 1998 and 99, sources told members of the company that that was a factor is really offensive to me.
One more question?
Last question. Yes, sir. I have a quick question. I'm interested in this in part. I grew up in Wyoming, but I haven't been back there for 25 years.
Yes.
And one question I had is, as far as the methamphetamine problem,
yes,
would you say it's, Wyoming, it's not very populous, but I could say that maybe criminals might feel that that's a good place to set up shop. There's not as many cops, would you say that the problem is far outsized in relation to the population when you compare it to other Western states in Wyoming?
Yes, it's, I believe, the least populated or second least populated. I think there are about 450,000 people in the state.
Yeah.
However, while that's true, it's also true that in the period around the time Matthew was attacked and for several years after that, 70% of crimes in the state of Wyoming were directly attributable to methamphetamine. For literally years, right around the crime and then for several years after, Wyoming had the highest per capita use of methamphetamine, meth abuse, in the nation, per capita.
Wow.
Can I make one other comment?
Sure.
Would that
be
okay? Because I think this is, I'll stay here. I think this has come up, and I'd like to actually, say something else about your question from the Laramie Project, and also the gentleman with the sharp bow tie there, in terms of some of the things you said. And the fact that I've been asked in numerous interviews about the state, about the Shepherd Foundation's statement about the book, innuendos and et cetera. If you haven't seen the statement, I'm sure you can find it online. In 2004, when I was doing the ABC News piece, I did an extensive videotaped interview with Jason Marsden, who is now the executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. And Jason made some very, very interesting comments that I think go to a little bit about what you're saying about, you know, how do I know this and my sources are unreliable about meth. But first, a little introduction to Jason's statement. Jason Marsden, the former journalist who now serves as executive director of the Matthew Shepard Foundation and also a friend of Matthew, told me in a 2004 interview, Jason was, in 1998 when this crime happened, he was a journalist working at the Casper Star Tribune. He was one of the first people to hear the news about the attack on Matthew. He says, "The quick and easy description of Matt Shepard gay bashed is about as far from the actual nuanced truth of what happened as it can get. It's offensive to see the truth boil down so much that it's no longer the truth. The horrible irony was that his death had an enormous amount to offer us in lessons, and that many of those were missed opportunities because of the shorthand of the media. You see the icon and how it differs from the real person, but there's been such tremendous value in that icon having been created, even if all you know is the barest misrepresentation of what took place. If it's important for you to know that, I'm glad that you do." This is a line from me as a lead-in to the second part of Jason's statement. Later in the same interview, when I asked Marsden about the possible role of drugs in Matthew's killing, he replied, quote, "Methamphetamine was a very big problem and very seldom discussed in Wyoming at that time. I remember thinking, especially when it started to come out, that McKinney was surrounded by people who were deep into the methamphetamine problem, that this was perhaps the most spectacular methamphetamine-related crime that had ever happened in Wyoming. It was very clear 10 years ago to those who were watching this problem emerge that it was going to become a scourge in Middle America, in our rural communities. It dominates life for a lot of people in our state. We've got needles on the side of the road in Wyoming. Drug lab materials are thrown out the window of someone's car on the interstate. I remember thinking at the time that the Matt Shepard case would forever go down in history as, you know, one of the saddest examples of gay bashing. But what it also was one of the saddest examples of the desperate lengths people on methamphetamine will go to." My paragraph after Jason's quote was this: "What Marsden and others may not have realized at the time was that Aaron was not the only figure in this tragedy surrounded by people who were deep into the methamphetamine problem. The ravages of meth, which helped destroy Matthew's life, not to mention the lives of Aaron and Russell, and the shattering impact on the families of all three, were never adequately examined or brought to light, and in some cases were deliberately covered up." Thank you. Thanks very much.